I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has apologized for remarks he made on Election Day about Arab-Israeli voters. He had declared the right-wing government is in danger. Arab voters are going en masse to the polls. Left-wing NGOs are bringing them on buses. On Monday, Netanyahu said he knew he hurt Arab-Israeli citizens. That was not my intention, and I am sorry. Netanyahu has also walked back remarks he made during the election that there would be no Palestinian state as long as he was the leader of Israel. A day after the election, he said he wanted a peaceful, sustainable two-state solution, but circumstances have to change. And yesterday, Dennis McDonough, President Obama's chief of staff, spoke at the annual J Street conference and told the liberal pro-Israel group, "We cannot simply pretend these comments were never made." He went on to say, "Israel cannot maintain military control of another people indefinitely. An occupation that has lasted for almost 50 years must end." This is our topic for today's Radio Times. We have two guests who have joined us. Daniel Kurtzer is professor of Middle East policy studies at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. During his 29-year career, I should say, in the U.S. Foreign Service, he served as U.S. Ambassador to Egypt and U.S. Ambassador to Israel. He's written a number of books about the Arab-Israeli conflict, the most recent titled The Peace Puzzle, America's Quest for Arab-Israeli Peace, 1989 to 2011. Daniel Kurtzer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's good to be here.
Nice to have you here. And also with us is Natan Sachs. He's a fellow at the Brookings Institution Center for Middle East Policy, where he researches Israeli foreign policy, Israeli domestic politics, the Arab-Israeli conflict. And he's currently writing a book on the domestic politics of Israel's foreign policy. And Natan Sachs, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. My pleasure to be back.
And to you, Daniel Kurtzer, are we witnessing, are we watching the disintegration of the relationship between these two allies?
I think it's too strong to say disintegration. We certainly are in a crisis at the top. The two leaders, President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu, don't trust each other. They don't like each other. They're tending to find the most negative interpretations of what each other does. And that's only getting worse. There's still an enduring set of interests that we share. We share intelligence. We share strategic cooperation and so forth. There are also persistent problems that we share. We differ for many years over settlements in the occupied territories, over occupation practices. But the really toxic problem now is the relationship between the two leaders. And frankly, even in the last few days, it's gotten worse.
How do you see it, Natan?
I agree completely. I think another aspect to it is a very deep difference on policy on Iran. Not only are the leaders, not only do they have a bad relationship between them, they also see things very deeply on Iran, differently. And we saw that in the speech that the Prime Minister gave to Congress. In part, that of course was timed with the election, and in part that was a partisan game perhaps. But we also saw very different opinions on how to proceed with the P5 plus 1 negotiations with Iran. The administration is going for a deal, at least a framework for a deal that may be signed very soon. The Israelis are vehemently opposed to it.
Natan, do you think Netanyahu's speech to the U.S. Congress, did that help him win, or were there more domestic, more local issues in Israel that mattered more?
It's a hard thing to say. When I saw it, I thought that on the one hand, the Israeli voters seemed to be quite cynical about his motives. Many thought that he was trying to play the domestic card, and many also blamed him for the crisis with the administration in going to Congress. But on the other hand, the spectacle, to my mind, was brilliant politics. He spoke in eloquent English and a very good oratory to roaring applause in the very august setting. And all that is excellent images for a campaign. Afterwards, though, we did not see a big bump. I may have simply been wrong. We did not see a big bump in the polls. On the other hand, he did manage to keep things, at least for a while longer, on foreign policy, which was always the prime minister's forte. Domestic politics, domestic economics are what helped the opposition. He was always stronger on foreign policy, on national security, and a bit on identity issues. And we saw in the end, after the speech, and probably unrelated to it, he managed to rally the right around him.
To you, Daniel Kurtzer, this was a speech. We actually did a show about it shortly after it was given that was organized by the Israeli ambassador, Ron Dermer. The president was not notified. Do you think the president is owed an apology by Benjamin Netanyahu?
Oh, he certainly is. You know, the White House immediately called it a breach of diplomatic protocol, which is a nice way of saying, why did you diss me? If you wanted to talk about Iran and you thought you needed a public forum, let's talk about it and come to Washington and meet in the White House, and we'll see if we can arrange something in Congress. But this was clearly a political ploy conceived by a combination of the Republicans and the Israeli ambassador in order to push back against the president. Recall that it was announced the day after the State of the Union speech when the president had said that he would veto any congressional action on sanctions. So Natan is right. It was a spectacle. The problem with this spectacle is it didn't accomplish anything substantively, didn't change any minds, and in fact, in some ways may have backfired because it did drive the Democrats away from what looked like the beginning of a real push to assert congressional control over this process. And the Democrats backed away largely in solidarity with the White House.
But do you think how can this relationship between these two leaders be mended, if at all?
Well, I think, first of all, the advice I would give to both sides is cut down and cut back on the public statements. There's just too much communication going on now by anonymous spokespeople or even official spokespeople. And every day you're seeing the problem exacerbated. Second, Natan is right. The substantive differences on Iran are quite deep. But the reality also is that this is a negotiation. We're not done yet. And it's really absurd that people are drawing conclusions from really incomplete information about a very complex negotiation. We wouldn't draw conclusions like that in a business deal. Why should we do so in this kind of a deal? So it's okay to put your positions out in public, but I would tone down the rhetoric on both sides, Israeli criticisms of the negotiations and American criticisms of Netanyahu's statements and policies.
Natan, the Wall Street Journal is reporting today that Israel spied on the U.S.-Iranian nuclear talks and shared some of that information with Republicans, opponents of President Obama's in the United States. Now, Israel denies this, or certainly denies that they shared this information, but this is, I guess, another piece of this contentious relationship and a lot of finger-pointing back and forth.
It is, and it's very troubling. It echoes previous crises, especially the Pollard affair, when there was, in fact, Israeli spying. Israelis deny vehemently that they spy on the United States. And I should say they deny not only in the usual way that every country denies spying. They deny in every aspect, and they deny it in private as well as in public. The same information that the Israelis apparently gave to someone or reportedly gave to someone can also be acquired in other means. You can spy on the Iranians. You can spy on someone else. This does not have to entail spying in the United States. So I would take it with a grain of salt, the report that Israel actually did this in the United States. But nonetheless, it's this rhetoric. As Ambassador Kurtz said, this rhetoric in the public seems to be where the relationship is at the moment. And that's really not the way it usually is between such two close allies that can easily pick up the phone. The president and the prime minister have spoken often, and the prime minister knows everyone else in Washington. There really is very little need to do so much in public, starting with a speech in Congress, of course, with the president's opponents, and throughout the past few weeks.
Well, and it seems to underscore this narrative, Daniel Kurtzer, about Republicans, their opposition to President Obama's negotiations, their invitation to Benjamin Netanyahu. John Boehner and some others are going to Israel. Do you see this as part of this very sort of partisan, has created, I guess, even more partisanship in this country?
You know, Marty, in some respects, this is the most dangerous of all the aspects of the dispute between our two countries. We've had problems before, 1975 and the Ford administration, the Carter administration, the George H.W. Bush administration. It's not unusual for two countries, even allies, to have differences. But what you have here that's fundamentally different from anything in the past is the degree to which an Israeli prime minister has reached around, a sitting president, and B, an entire party within our government structure to establish a kind of alliance with the Republicans. Now, he's doing it, obviously, because he believes that that can help him with respect to Iran nuclear issue. But the long-term consequences for Israel are really quite devastating. Israel should not be a partisan issue in this country. The issues with which we deal with Israel are nonpartisan. They're strategic. They're important diplomatically. But once you've brought Israel into our domestic political debate, I think it's a very serious problem.
Well, Natan, I'd like to have you respond to that. And I'm just thinking about Dennis McDonough's speech to J Street yesterday. And does this create either divisions in this country among Jews, or does it sort of underscore the differences that have been there all along?
I think Ambassador Kurtz put it well. It's a true danger for the Israeli position in the United States and for support of Israel. Israel has long time been a bipartisan issue, and if anything, it had stronger support among Democrats. Harry Truman was the president who recognized Israel 11 minutes after it was declared, and most Jews, about two-thirds of them, vote for Democrats. Of course, Jews are not the bedrock of support for Israel. There's much, much wider support for Israel in the United States, but nonetheless, that's, of course, telling. Now we see younger Democrats, just one generation or half a generation below the top leadership, looking at their leaders, the people they campaigned for and the people they probably like, in extreme conflict or seeming extreme conflict with the Israeli prime minister. They see the president and the Israeli prime minister in this kind of conflict. They see Nancy Pelosi and others. And I'm sure they're taking cues. This is, in the long term, very dangerous for Israel and is not the way usually Israelis have conducted themselves in the United States, which was always to try and garner bipartisan support, certainly from the Democrats and also from Republicans. There is, I think the prime minister in his mind, the way he speaks about Iran is as a historical generational challenge. And I tend to believe him in the sense that he believes that. I think he thinks this is the ultimate test of his prime ministership. And in that regard, he's willing, in a sense, to risk some strategic assets that Israel has, namely the bipartisan support, for the sake of something that he thinks is even more important. But this is very dangerous. And in the long term, Israel could pay a price. The American political system could also pay a price. If I may, one more word on this. If you think
sure,
of the
ahead.
Last presidential campaign, Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, President Obama then, they were debating foreign policy. Israel came up, I believe it was 30-something times, much more than China or any other country. And this is partly because Americans care a lot about Israel, but it's partly because the Republicans identified a political weakness on Israel for the Democrats and for the president. And the president recognized the same thing and felt a political need to defend his record and rightly show that he had that cooperation on security and intelligence is excellent, maybe unprecedented. But this shows the political issue here. The Republicans saw a political advantage, and the Democrats saw a need to defend it. And this is a sign, I think, of things to come, and they will probably get even worse.
We have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Much more to talk about. That's Natan Sachs, a fellow at the Brookings Institution Center for Middle East Policy. Also with us, Daniel Kurtzer, former U.S. ambassador to Israel, also U.S. ambassador to Egypt. And he's currently a Middle East Policy Studies professor at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. And we're talking about the relationship between the U.S. and Israel. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. Much more. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We are talking about what Benjamin Netanyahu's re-election means for the future of U.S.-Israeli relations, especially in light of the rift between the White House and the Israeli leader. And again, talking with Daniel Kurtzer and Natan Sachs. And to join our conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. To you, Daniel Kurtzer, you've written several books about the Arab-Israeli conflict. I've interviewed you, I don't know how many times, about the peace process and the parts of the peace process that need to come together in order to create a two-state solution. Is that peace process dead?
Well, the idea of a two-state solution is not dead because there's no alternative. People have thought about all kinds of ideas, one state, three states, no states, federations, and they all don't work. So at some point, the political systems of both Israel and the Palestinian Authority will come back to it. But I think the process of arriving at that outcome needs to be thought about again. John Kerry tried very hard, and I thought during his diplomacy he was actually progressing nicely. And it failed about a year ago. Now with the re-election of Prime Minister Netanyahu and his, let's call them, ambiguous statements about a Palestinian state, I think the chances of reaching that two-state solution during his prime ministry are about zero. And therefore, there are alternatives to think about. The administration, for example, has floated the idea that it might support something in the United Nations that at least puts the international community on record for what it supports for the time when Israel and the Palestinians are ready to negotiate. I think that's probably the order of business for the foreseeable future.
Natan, the president was interviewed by the Huffington Post and said it's going to be hard to find a path where people are seriously believing that negotiations are possible. Does it make sense then to go this UN route?
It might. There's, of course, a danger. The danger is that if you put forward a detailed plan or position of the international community, you're also inviting the two sides to point out exactly what they don't like about the deal. It may be worth taking the risk, but the risk is serious. If you think about it, the different aspects of a final status agreement, in particular Jerusalem, Palestinian refugees, borders, security, all these things, each one of them is very hard to agree upon between the two sides. But all together, you may find a deal where the Palestinians may give more on the refugees, for example. Israel may give more than it wants on Jerusalem, for example. But all this works only in concert and only if each side believes that the other side has said yes. If you have an international proposal, then, of course, there's a risk that each side sees the other side has not agreed to this, and therefore I, as a negotiator, have to point out exactly the problems on the issues I care most about. And we risk each side painting itself into a corner and making very strong statements about what it will not do. We've seen some things even in the last negotiations that Ambassador Kurtzer mentioned last year, where things that may have been resolved quietly in the end of negotiations, such as recognizing Israel as a Jewish state, once they were made a huge public issue, the Palestinians had to pull back and made it for them a big no. This is a risk. It may be worth taking since we do need to figure out how to keep the two-state solution as a clear, viable option for years to come, probably. But that risk is formidable.
Let me pick up on that. And to go to you, Daniel Kurtzer, because this is something that Benjamin Netanyahu said, which is that the Palestinian Authority, Abu Mazen, has not recognized the Israeli state. Is that true?
Oh, no. Abu Mazen and the PLO have recognized Israel formally and repeatedly, both in public and private, since 1993, the Oslo Accords. What Netanyahu has been looking for is something quite more specific, and that is a recognition of Israel's character as a Jewish state. And Abu Mazen has said that Israel can determine its own character, but diplomatically, you're only asked to recognize what a state is called. You're not asked to recognize its character, and therefore he has been concerned that anything beyond recognizing the state of Israel might call into question the rights of Israeli citizens who are not Jewish. It's an issue that has played into some prominence since Netanyahu articulated in 2009. There are many who think that it's a false issue, that it's an issue designed to create barriers. I happen to agree with that assessment. I think it's a non-issue substantively, and that, in fact, Israel doesn't need anybody else to tell it what it is. It can decide what its own character is. What it does need is continued Palestinian recognition of Israel's right to exist as an independent state.
We have an email from Charlie. I'm going to give this to you, Natan. He says, Israel presently and really never has had a partner with which to negotiate. Who leads the Palestinians? Hamas, the PLO, neither of which has even yet recognized Israel's right to exist. He goes on to say, to date, any and all steps taken toward a two-state solution, leaving Gaza, etc., have all been undertaken by Israel. Nothing has been undertaken by the other side. Do you agree with that, Natan?
No, I don't. I think, first and foremost, there's a big difference between Hamas and PLO. PLO has recognized Israel's right to exist, and that was crucial to the Oslo process. I do share the caller's deep concern about the Palestinian leadership. First, we have this huge division between Hamas and Fatah, the Palestinian Authority based in Ramallah. The West Bank and the Gaza Strip are essentially governed completely separately, and Hamas is vehemently opposed to dealing with Israel in a peaceful way. Secondly, even within the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah and President Abbas, this political situation there is very dire. He himself seems to be very weak within his own leadership, has lost a lot of the credibility he once had, perhaps, and he's never shown himself to be a very courageous leader. Even in his last negotiations, it should be remembered, they ended really when he refused to answer the president on the framework agreement that the president put forward, a secret one for now. And so I do very much share the concern about the Palestinian leadership. But the question, therefore, is how does one preserve the possibility of reaching the only viable solution from Israel's standpoint, the U.S. standpoint, and also the Palestinian standpoint, in absence of a serious Palestinian leadership? Of course, the Palestinians now question dramatically, and they have for a long time, the possibility of reaching a deal with Benjamin Netanyahu. So we have a very difficult situation where on both sides the leaderships are probably not there, and on the Palestinian side they may not have the ability to do it if they needed to. The biggest challenge, therefore, is to maintain this option open. How do you keep it viable for perhaps a change of leadership on the Palestinian side and maybe changes in Israel in the future?
To you, Daniel Kurtzer, how, though, do settlements make a two-state solution possible?
Well, that's been a persistent problem since a little after the 1967 war when the settlements issue came to the fore. Palestinians make the argument, which successive American administrations have agreed, that you can't be negotiating over a territory which is being eaten up at the same time by unilateral Israeli actions. You know, for many years, the settlements issue was relatively insignificant. It was small. But it has blossomed and grown quite substantially in recent years, not just in the big settlement blocks that adjoin the former Green Line between Israel and the West Bank, but also on the ridgeline outside of major cities in ways that definitely impede the idea of a contiguous, accessible Palestinian state. So it's a serious problem. The Obama administration in 2009 tried to seek a complete settlements freeze. It was not successful. There have been efforts to moderate settlement activity. Some of them were a little bit more successful in recent years. But with a right-wing coalition about to emerge in Israel, one can forecast a spurt in settlement activity that will definitely make matters worse as we're in this holding period until the prospects re-arise for a possible peace process.
And that's Daniel Kurtzer. He's a professor of Middle East Policy Studies at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. He served as U.S. Ambassador to Israel, also U.S. Ambassador to Egypt. Also with us is Nitan Sachs. He's a fellow at the Brookings Institution Center for Middle East Policy. And we are talking about the U.S.-Israeli relationship. It has undergone some challenges in the last couple of weeks. Benjamin Netanyahu reelected as Prime Minister of Israel, but after a rather contentious election, a speech here in the United States. To join our conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. What do you think can help mend this relationship such as it is? To you, Nitan Sachs, the U.S. sends something like $3 billion a year to Israel, I guess largely for military aid. Does the U.S. have leverage that they can use that money to try to get Israel to do more for the peace process?
Well, the president has made clear, and it's been the policy of the U.S. for quite a while, that the military aid that you mentioned is not part of that game. It is, of course, a very central element in the relationship. It's also very important for Israeli security. This money, should be noted, is spent in the United States. So in essence, it's aid in materiel, in arms and platforms that are sold to Israel with U.S. money. But it's a very considerable, of course, sum, and it's a big, important aspect in Israeli security. Israelis know very well how important the alliance is in the United States for them. And it's not just the aid. It's many other things. It's, of course, the help in the United Nations, where the United States has a veto power in the Security Council. And it's very many other aspects. They have leverage, of course, with the Israelis. But I think the lack of trust now between the leaders does dampen things. Ambassador Kurtzer mentioned the attempt at the beginning of the Obama administration to have a complete freeze on settlements, later quiet understandings about what might be done, which were partly implemented. In previous administrations, there were also ability, although not ever to get a full freeze of settlements, to be able to affect Israeli policy on this. The less trust there is between the leaders, the harder it is. And this, I'm afraid, is where we are at the moment.
Well, and I keep going back to this, and I keep going back to you then, Daniel Kurtzer. I mean, are you then looking for some kind of a meeting between Netanyahu and Obama privately somewhere where they can hash out some of their disagreements?
Well, at this stage, Marty, I think a face-to-face meeting is probably not wise. I think there has to be some quiet back-channel discussions among trusted aides in order to set an agenda and create some space for the two of them to talk civilly to each other. I'd also just note, Natan suggested that all of the military aid was spent in the United States. That's not exactly accurate. Three-quarters of it is spent in the United States. Israel has a special exemption by which a quarter of its military aid is actually spent in Israel, which adds to Israel's economic activity. So there are real consequences to any question of a diminution of American aid. I think Natan's right. There will not be any effort to touch the security assistance. But there's a large volume of aid that we provide to Israel in addition to that security assistance that may come into question at some point in reaction to American anger over settlements. And for that reason, Marty, as you're asking, how do you get this thing back together again?
Exactly.
I think the two sides just have to start talking more civilly through our ambassador in Israel. I'm not sure it can be done through the Israeli ambassador in Washington, who may have lost the ability to talk to the administration. But through special envoys and other visitors, try to get this thing rolling again.
But you're saying these two leaders cannot sit down in the same room together?
Right now, they'd only do so if they were forced to do so, and it would be a very strained and probably very difficult meeting. We saw in the last couple of days, President Obama called Prime Minister Netanyahu to congratulate him on the victory of the Likud party. And from what we understand, it was a very testy conversation. So even in a congratulatory phone call, the two of them couldn't quite see eye to eye.
John McCain said it. I think he was on CNN State of the Union on Sunday. He said the president should get over it. Get over your temper tantrum, Mr. President. The least of your problems are what Bibi Netanyahu said in a political campaign, sort of just adding to the tense atmosphere, Daniel Kurtzer.
Well, it's cute that the Republicans are making that argument. They've been as much a part of the problem as everybody else has been. They share equal responsibility with the president and the prime minister for making things worse. So, I would discount what McCain or Lindsey Graham or the Republicans are saying. They're playing this as much as they can to continue to put the Democrats and the president in a corner. But far more important than the domestic political games is the question of whether or not these two leaders can find some common language. And I think they can ultimately, but it's probably not best to try to do that initially through a summit.
To you, Natan Sachs, and does Israel need the U.S. more than the U.S. needs Israel? Sort of putting it in this kind of stark terms there, but who's calling the shots here?
Well, there's no question that the small country in the Middle East needs a superpower much more than the other way around. And most Israelis know this. Sometimes you hear a comment to the contrary. But fundamentally, if you ask most serious Israelis, of course they acknowledge this, and they're extremely grateful for American support. Who's in the driver's seat is a good question. And I think part of it is not just an ego game. I think Senator McCain, when he spoke about the president getting over it, he was painting it as if it's just a tantrum, as if it's just the president angry at something unpleasant that the prime minister said. That's not the case. The reason that people were very upset with the prime minister saying what he said about the two-state solution is that, to begin with, people had doubts about his sincerity on this. And, of course, the president and the American administration put enormous efforts into the peace process last year, spent a lot of time, of the Secretary of State in particular, on this issue. And the notion that now the prime minister is perhaps suggesting that it would never happen on his watch adds to the credibility problem and puts in question the time the administration spent on this. Of course, the problem is that it's not just the two leaders. If you look at the two leaders and how they're perceived in the other country, there's a problem there. Mm. Usually in Israeli politics, Israelis, since they are very well aware of how important the support from the superpower of the United States is, they don't like their prime ministers to argue with the president. We've seen in the past some of the previous incidents that Ambassador Kurtzer mentioned, for example, when George H.W. Bush and Yitzhak Shamir had a very difficult relationship. Yitzhak Rabin from Labor, who beat Yitzhak Shamir in 1992, gained from that. And the same is true with even Benjamin Netanyahu, with a very bad relationship with Bill Clinton, and he probably suffered from that electorally when he lost in 1999 to Ehud Barak. This is not so much the case right now, and that's in part because just as Benjamin Netanyahu has very many detractors in the United States, the truth is that President Obama is not popular in Israel. If Bill Clinton were the president right now, he was extremely popular in Israel. President Obama, for a variety of different reasons, not all his own fault, has failed to gain the trust of Israelis. Of course, he doesn't have to do that. They're not his constituency. But this means that he has less political leverage over the prime minister, and that hinders somewhat his ability to gain leverage over the prime minister on policy issues as well.
And we're almost having a break here. Daniel Kurtzer, do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, I do, very much so. Since 2009, when President Obama was elected, his popularity in Israel was extraordinarily low. I don't think he cared that much. He believed that if he did the right thing, it would end up being good for both Israel and the United States. And neither side worked very hard since then to build the kind of trust and, you know, the emotional side of the relationship. And in a sense, all of the other problems that have surfaced now are resting on this foundation of several years of mistrust and a lack of emotional appeal.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Daniel Kurtzer and Nathan Sachs, and we are talking about the relationship between Israel and the United States. We're going to take a short break, get some more comments in from folks sending us emails, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times and give us a call. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. And stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about what the re-election of Benjamin Netanyahu as Prime Minister of Israel, what that means for the future of the U.S.-Israeli relationship, the peace process, as we have been discussing. The relationship between Netanyahu and President Obama has never been warm. And down right about now, it's pretty frosty. Talking with Nathan Sachs, a fellow at the Brookings Institution's Center for Middle East Policy. He's also writing a book on the domestic politics of Israel's foreign policy. And Daniel Kurtzer is with us. He served as U.S. ambassador to Israel and to Egypt, and he's a professor at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. And you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Daniel Kurtzer, let me go back to something you wrote in Politico. This had to do with Netanyahu's speech at before the U.S. Congress, raising some questions about whether Sheldon Adelson was behind this speech or not. You raised the question, and I wonder whether you have any more information about that.
I really don't, and I wrote that paragraph very carefully as a speculative paragraph. We know that Adelson has been a major funder of Netanyahu for a number of years, including purchasing media outlets in Israel that are more or less Netanyahu clarion calls. And it's not unlikely that there was some involvement in Netanyahu's decision to do this. Adelson was sitting in the gallery in the Congress. There were some funny stories about the Republicans that Adelson was funding and relationship with them during that period. So it was a speculative paragraph, but one that I think is important. Hopefully that people will analyze it and delve into it more deeply. Interestingly, during the election campaign, Netanyahu accused the left of gaining foreign funding and encouraging the leftists to overthrow him, which was a bit ironic given the degree to which much of his own political support has been gained from people like Sheldon Adelson.
We have an email from Dottie. I'll put this to you, Nitan. Does your guest think that the Republican right-wing support of Israel is more about establishing the state as a precursor to the second coming of Christ?
The short answer is I don't know. The longer answer is there is a very wide support among Christian evangelicals, conservative Christian evangelicals, for Israel, and that's been growing in recent years or decades. And that's a very central part of the support, the American support in general, and the Republican support in particular. I don't know to say whether how much of that is eschatological and has to do with the end of days, and how much of that is an affinity based probably on religion and other issues. But support for Israel is widespread. It's very widespread beyond the Christian evangelical community. Of course, Jews tend to support Israel, but many others, much larger groups, do as well. So do the Republicans do it because of that? Perhaps. If you look at public polls, though, support for Israel is very strong across districts and across demographics. That's the main reason that congressmen and senators support Israel, is because that's what their constituencies want them to do. We've seen that when lobbies, for example, pro-Israel lobbies have lobbied in one direction, but the public was in another, the lobby lost. The fundamental reason is that it's very popular among Americans, and as the caller suggests, I'm sure among some, it has to do with religion and even eschatology.
And do you think that relationship or the regard that many Americans have for Israel, do you think that's at risk, Daniel?
I don't think it's at risk, but there certainly are a lot more questions being raised now. As we are talking today, there's a conference in Washington of the J Street organization, and they believe that they've been infused with a new kind of enthusiasm because they think that they can build support for their pro-peace, pro-Israel positions on the back of what looks like Netanyahu's vacillation on this question. We do know from other studies, the Pew Research Institute did a study, it must have been about 2 years ago, that suggested that there was a diminution of support even among American Jews for Israel, not opposition, but kind of turning off, not associating itself or themselves as much as their parents' generation in a kind of active way. And I think for Israel, that's something to watch very carefully.
You think that's a generational issue, Nitan?
I think part of it is, yes. And I think Israel really has a danger of appearing to be in contrast with liberalism. For many young liberals in particular, I mentioned before that they look at their leaders and see them in conflict with Netanyahu. It's not just that. They also, Democrats in particular, see themselves as liberals and view Israel now in contrast to it, mostly because of the occupation and the settlements. And this is a very serious danger for Israel. Convincing Americans that the control of the West Bank is not only Israel's fault or would end if Israel could it, et cetera, is a very difficult task to do, in particular because of the settlements. And this runs the risk of making liberals in particular either tune away or, as Ambassador Chris has said, just turn off. They just might care less about it, and this is quite dangerous for Israel.
Well, in fact, an email from Beverly speaking to that point, she says, my support for Israel has taken a nosedive. It's not just that Benjamin Netanyahu showed his blatant disrespect of President Obama and the American people with his speech to Congress and his racism and fear-mongering before the election, but also that after all of that, the Israeli people elected him. And that's an email from Beverly, obviously feeling very strongly about what Benjamin Netanyahu did and said. Daniel Kircher?
Sure. Sure. I think that's symptomatic of what we've been talking about. I'd also add, since I'm on a university campus, that this is one of the places to watch. Universities around the country are looking at questions of what's called boycott, sanctions, and divestment from Israel. Most of these initiatives have not succeeded, but some have. Some academic organizations have thought about or even started to try to boycott Israeli academics. These are all very early stages, but they're very dangerous indicators of a trend that I think Nathan has put his finger on, which is, does Israel position itself as an anti-liberal society when for so many years it was a kind of beacon of a liberal democracy? And if that perception changes, then there'll be a lot of places to watch these problems erupt.
I'm curious about, Nitan, from your perspective, whether you think the more volatile Middle East with the emergence of ISIS and a number of countries that are really in shambles or in some state of civil war, whether that also has affected the peace process, because it seems like such a much more dangerous place than it used to be.
Without a doubt. And it affected both the peace process and the way Israelis vote and the way Israelis responded to the vacillations of the prime minister about the two-state solution. It's very easy in the Middle East, in Israel, to make the argument that this is not the time to take big risks. If you look around Israel, to the south, the Sinai is now being pacified more or less by President Sisi of Egypt with very brutal means, and that's no guarantee that it will remain pacified. In the north, there is the absolute horror of the civil war in Syria, Lebanon, in which Hezbollah is the main force, and Jordan, which is secure and stable, but has threats from the east and from the north, ISIS and others. And that's not even mentioning Iran. So for the Israeli voters, when they hear even what I said earlier about liberalism, etc., it can seem a bit detached from reality. Reality, from that vantage point, is one of extreme threats where there is absolutely no liberalism in any direction, no matter where you look. Even the nicest countries are very far from what we or Israelis would perceive as liberalism. And so then to quibble about exactly what the prime minister said or not to some Israeli voters can seem detached from reality, which is one of extreme risk. That affects both their perception of the peace process and their judgment of what the prime minister said, but even their voting to a certain degree. The prime minister, there were many things going for him, but one of the main things was that he was perceived as the steady hand, the one who has all the experience on security matters, and was able to stand tough in front before the world and even before the president of the United States and demand Israeli security in a time in which that is very much in question in the Israeli perception, whether or not it's in fact true.
To you, Daniel, what will you be looking at as you look at this coalition government that's been formed?
Well, if it in fact emerges over the next couple of weeks that it focuses entirely on what I guess we would call right-wing parties, there's a block of 67 seats that will probably comprise Netanyahu's coalition. The three things to look at, number one would be the degree to which the coalition arrangements require Netanyahu to support enhanced settlement activity. The settlers have already made demands in this regard, and they're probably going to get support, at least from some of the right-wing parties, that a settlements agenda be part of the game plan. Number two, it'll be important to watch how Netanyahu navigates this question of whether he supports a two-state solution. Rhetorically, he has tried to backtrack from what looked like his opposition to that. But the administration, at least, wants to see what that means in reality. And mm-hmm. It's going to be quite hard for him to navigate that. There's a third issue which kind of got lost in all of this discussion, and that is the economic and social issues that face Israel. It's a country that's experiencing an economic boom, but also a growing gap between rich and poor. And Netanyahu's going to have to tackle that, even though, in effect, it was not part of his own campaign. One of his key coalition partners, the Kulanu Party, led by Moshe Kahlon, will make this a major demand. And it'll be hard for Netanyahu to respond entirely to that if he's also dumping money into settlements in the West Bank.
Oh, interesting. Let's see what Barry from, looks like Chester County, has to say. And Barry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
This is nothing new with Netanyahu. This is a longstanding anti-feeling in the United States with policy against the Likud and Herut. And this goes back to the sinking of the ship, the Altalena, back in 47, 48 in the area. And I just think there's a prejudicial opinion as to which government they want to see in power.
Barry, I don't entirely understand. What is your question?
My question?
Yes.
Oh, is just why is there this always a leaning toward, as was just mentioned about the liberal aspect, leaning toward the governments that necessarily, I mean, what's going to happen if Iran gets the bomb?
Well, I mean, that's certainly a question that hangs over a lot of this conversation to you, Netan, and obviously that's what the U.S. and its partners are trying to negotiate. And as you both have said, Daniel Kurtzer as well, this concern about whatever this negotiation comes up with. Can you speak to that?
Yes, I mean, I think this is very central to the way the prime minister views the conflict with the president at the moment and vice versa. Whether or not there's prejudice against Likud governments, I think on this issue there is a very big difference. In particular, the Israelis are worried that the deal, if the leaks are to be trusted, and of course we do not know the details, just as Ambassador Kurtz has said, would have a time horizon that is too short. It may expire after 10 or 15 years, and it may allow thousands of centrifuges to continue operating in Iran. And all this, in a sense, from the Israeli perspective, could let Iran off the hook without dismantling the nuclear facilities, the possibility of Iran breaking through to a nuclear weapon at a time of its choosing. Now, of course, the big question, and I think there are serious concerns there, by the way. I don't think it's all up in the air, but I do think the main question, of course, is one of alternative. If there is no deal like this, what is the suggestion? The prime minister, in his speech to Congress, suggested that a much better deal could be reached in negotiations. I'm skeptical of that. And the question, therefore, is could deterrence, or deterrence of a non-nuclear Iran, in a sense, prevent it from breaking through? And is that the kind of risk one wants to take? It's not an easy question. And I think the animosity between the leaders has made this partly into a partisan issue and one of allegiances, where people feel closer to one of the leaders and therefore are sure that that position is right. I think this is a difficult question. I'm curious to see what the details of the deal are, if they are reached. And I think we should keep a very open mind about the details.
Do you think, Daniel Kurtzer, that that Israel has is facing an existential threat from Iran?
Well, Marty, first, just one comment on Barry's
sure.
question. I don't agree that there's some kind of inherent bias. If you look at three of the four Likud governments since the late 1970s, the U.S. has gotten along quite well. With Menachem Begin, we helped negotiate the peace treaty with Egypt. With Yitzhak Shamir, we helped bring about the Madrid Peace Conference. And I served in Israel as ambassador with Ariel Sharon, where there was a very strong condominium of interests with the George W. Bush administration. The problems with Likud have been confined to the Netanyahu-led governments in the 1990s and today. So I think Barry might want to revisit some of his thinking. With respect to Iran, Prime Minister certainly believes that this is existential. And in fact, there are some Iranian statements that can be pointed to that suggest that if they had the bomb, they would try their best to do away with what they call the Zionist regime. But, you know, Iran is a much more complex society than simply personified by the supreme leader or even by the Revolutionary Guards. There's a complex decision-making structure. There's its own kinds of checks and balances. It's not the democracy that we enjoy here. But it's not so simple to suggest that the simple acquisition of a capability means they're going to use it. I think Israel has serious reason to be concerned. I think it is fair and reasonable for them to be looking very carefully at any kind of a negotiated outcome. But I'd also look at one historical aspect here, Marty, and that is during a period when there were no negotiations with Iran, Iran's nuclear capabilities increased exponentially. Hmm. From 2000 to 2008, they went from almost no centrifuges to, I don't know, 10 or 11,000. Negotiations have at least slowed this down and hopefully can slow it down even further. And I think that's what needs to be watched.
Well, we have to end on that note. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Daniel Kurtzer, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And he's professor of Middle East Policy Studies at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. Natan Sachs, thank you very much as well.
My pleasure. Thank you both.
You're very welcome. Fellow at the Brookings Institution Center for the Middle East Policy. We are to send us an email, find out more about the show, go to whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.